Bueno, repito para los que no oyeron, bienvenidos, es muy agradable ver un auditorio tan diverso en el marco de una reunión de literatura, un festival de literatura, interesados en oír hablar de evolución y de las implicaciones de la evolución. Hemos venido tratando esto en el último año en muy diversos foros, básicamente porque estábamos celebrando los 200 años de Darwin y 250 años de la publicación del Origen de las Especies. Y el mundo nunca fue igual después de la publicación del Origen de las Especies. Nos cambió todo, el concepto que tenemos de nosotros mismos, el concepto que tenemos del mundo alrededor de las demás especies en relación con nosotros. Y si a eso suma la explosión de la biología molecular de los últimos años, pues se pueden dar cuenta que estamos presenciando a principios del siglo XXI un nuevo concepto de quiénes somos, de dónde venimos y para dónde vamos. Y esas son las preguntas que se hizo ese sabio Omar el Khayyam, que preguntaba de dónde venimos y para dónde vamos. Si los seres humanos logramos saber eso, estaremos muy seguros de qué es lo que estamos haciendo. De modo que en el marco de eso, tener esta discusión tan interesante con Fern, seguramente que va a ser muy ilustrativa sobre esta temática. En el contexto de la aparición de la teoría de la evolución, aparece en 1976 Richard Dawkins y publica El gen egoísta, The Selfish Gene. Y se genera toda una nueva controversia que va hasta nuestros días. Es en esa nueva controversia en donde se inscribe el trabajo de Fern, con su libro, que teníamos por aquí a la mano, The Selfish Genius, el gen egoísta, el genio egoísta. De modo que a lo que nos vamos a dedicar en los próximos minutos va a ser explorar con Fern las apreciaciones de Richard Dawkins y la forma como Fern ha visto su trabajo, el trabajo de el gen egoísta y los demás libros que publicó después Richard Dawkins. Vamos a hacerlo aquí en adelante entre Fern y yo, en inglés y en español, en fin. Cuando los que no hablan inglés no entiendan es porque estamos hablando en español y entonces me hacen caer en cuenta y lo repetimos en español. Entonces lo primero que planteamos es que Fern nos cuente su libro, cuál es el sentido del libro, una síntesis rápida del libro que todavía no está en español y por lo tanto presumimos que ninguno de ustedes lo ha podido leer. So Fern, give us an overview of your book.
Thank you, Jamie, for such a wonderful introduction. And I'd just like to say what a pleasure it is to be here today. Sorry. Please let me know if you can't hear me or if I'm speaking too quickly, especially when I become animated about my subject. I tend to talk very quickly. Well, one of the things I guess that's important is to just outline some of the ideas that Richard Dawkins put forward. Hiya, okay. I can speak more loudly. Richard Dawkins, for those of you who aren't aware of who he is or what his scientific writing is, published a book, Selfish Gene, in 1976, as Jamie has outlined. He's also published numerous other works on evolutionary biology. And his main arguments in his scientific writings are that evolution is all about genes. So natural selection, which he argues is a central process of evolution, is only happening, the selection process is only happening at the level of genes. So he's what we tend to call a gene centricist. Now, Richard Dawkins is also quite well known for his writings about science and religion, and possibly the book that most people know him for nowadays is his book God Delusion, which was published in 2006. And here he extended his evolutionary science writings into his atheist arguments against religion. The problem here is that he combines his evolutionary writings with his arguments about religion, but we'll touch on that a bit later in conversation. One of the things that's important to recognise about Dawkins is that he's the most dominant voice in communicating evolutionary science, certainly in Britain, and in the US, and becoming more so internationally. He tends to be the person that people invite to give talks or make television programs or radio programs, and he's the seen as the figurehead of evolutionary sciences today. Some people even call him the Darwin of his generation. So he's very much seen to be the leader in evolutionary sciences. Now, this leads me to one of the key reasons why I wrote my book, which is that actually there is a lot more going on in evolutionary biology than Richard Dawkins outlines. One of the key areas that Dawkins is perhaps not reflecting that well. Sorry, this microphone is very sensitive. One of the areas that Dawkins isn't reflecting that well is some of the new research in how inheritance occurs and where variation between species come from. And this is something that the scientific community is very aware of. So there is quite a strong voice within the scientific community that rejects Dawkins' perspectives and sees him just as a bit of a hindrance for communicating scientific ideas. Which leads me on to why I wrote the book in the first place. Now, Dawkins is seen very much as a very dominant person within the British biological sciences public sphere. So I had people coming up to me when I was first writing the book saying, it's a very brave thing to do. You're taking on this man who has this huge public persona. Why are you doing this? It's because I feel quite passionately, for a number of reasons, both historically, philosophically, and scientifically, that Dawkins is actually doing us a disservice when it comes to communicating what is actually a very exciting field at the moment. Evolutionary biology is coming on in leaps and bounds, and there's some really, really interesting work going on at the moment that tells us so much more about how organisms, genes, and the environment all work together as a kind of interlinked system. So just to briefly outline some of the historical context for some of the scientific ideas that Jamie and I will talk about in a moment, there is an ongoing legacy in terms of the history of biology, whereby there is an idea called neo-Darwinism, which is the label which Dawkins himself chooses for himself, which has become the predominant view of how evolution works. Now, just to unpick this a little bit, it's important to go back to just before Darwin. Now, Darwin obviously is someone who has had a lot of attention in the past year because it's been his joint anniversary, so the 200th anniversary of his birth and the 150th anniversary of his... slower, okay. You see, as soon as I get into the history, which is one of my favourite bits, I talk more quickly. Okay, so it's the... The anniversary celebrations this year have led us to focus on Darwin a lot more. So one of the things that's really come out this year is that there's been a lot more discussion about Darwin in his historical context, which has been really, really quite interesting. And one of the things that this has shown in the public sphere is that Darwin wasn't a lone voice. He wasn't the first person to come up with ideas about species changing over time. What he did, and did very successfully, which is why it's important to celebrate his work, is he collected all of the evidence together to support his theories of evolution by means of natural selection. And he packaged them all together in a book which was accessible, readable, and in some ways quite poetic. If you read, for example, the last paragraph of Origin of Species, it is almost like a poem. The important point here is that he wasn't the first person to suggest that species change over time. Some of you may have heard of someone called Lamarck, who also had an anniversary last year. Last year was the 200th anniversary of the publication of his most famous book, which was Zoological Philosophy. Lamarck came up with an idea which is most often referred to as an inheritance of acquired characteristics. And I mention this because there's actually a very long, ongoing history of conflict between the idea of Lamarckism and the idea of Darwinism. To give you a basic idea of what inheritance of acquired characteristics is in a Lamarckian sense, it's quite often described as through two examples. One is the idea of a giraffe stretching its neck to reach leaves on a tree. So what it suggested Lamarck says is that an ancestor species to the giraffe will have a short neck, and by stretching to reach leaves at the higher points in a tree, it will, over successive generations, get a longer neck. And this is how giraffes came to have long necks. Obviously, we wouldn't necessarily think that this is correct today. The other example that's often used is that a blacksmith, through his lifetime, will be enlarging his muscles in his arm through working with heavy hammers at a forge. And that these large muscles that are acquired during his lifetime, so it's an acquired characteristic, are then inherited by his son. So they're two examples that are often used to describe Lamarck's work. But one of the things that's often forgotten about Lamarck's work is actually they were a very simplistic version of his arguments. What he was really arguing is that the variation between species, so which is one of the important facets of evolutionary theory, is there has to be difference between individual members of each species. He suggests that the variation in species and also the processes of inheritance are actually driven by external effects. So they can be driven by environmental triggers. Now, this part of Lamarck tends to get written out in the history. Now, if we fast forward from 1809 to 1859, when Darwin publishes Origin of Species, you might think, if you were to take a Dawkins perspective or read some of the popular history about Darwin, that Darwin completely rejects this idea of Lamarckism. This isn't the case. In the first edition of Origin of Species, right the way through to the sixth edition of Origin of Species, and in some of Darwin's later works, so Variation of Plants and Animals Under Domestication, which was published in 1868, there is the role of the environment. So he has different types of inheritance acquired characteristics, including the idea that's like the blacksmith's arm and the giraffe's necks, but he also allows a role for environmental triggers in producing variation between individuals in a species and also in the mechanisms of inheritance. So Darwin is actually a Lamarckian. In the way he thinks about inheritance and variation, he is Lamarckian. Now, this is written out of the history. And Darwin's version of inheritance, which he calls pangenesis, is often forgotten. It's not often written about. And it's sometimes seen as the desperate attempt of someone who couldn't understand inheritance, clinging on to an out-of-date Lamarckian idea. Now, Richard Dawkins is very anti-Lamarckian. He, as I said, is a neo-Darwinian. Now, neo-Darwinism is a term that was coined after Darwin's death in the 1880s to describe a new breed of research scientists who were desperately trying to work out the problem of inheritance and variation, something that Darwin could only speculate on. At this point, you're starting to get a lot of work done with microscopes. You've got the increased development of understanding of how cells work. You start to get a more refined understanding of the processes that are going on and contribute towards inheritance. Now, the archetypal neo-Darwinian is someone called August Weismann, and he puts up this idea called Weismann's barrier. And it may seem like I'm giving you a rather long journey through the history here, but some of these ideas are still quite prevalent today. And what we'll be talking about in terms of current science is actually challenging some of these ideas. And this is why it's quite an exciting period in the biological sciences. But just to explain, Weismann's barrier. He is seen as the person who finally rejects and destroys the idea of Lamarckism. He says that the reproductive cell, what he called a germline, and what we might today think of as our genes. The reproductive cell is isolated. It's separated off from the body cells and from any environmental triggers. Nothing can change the germline or the gene line. It's immortal in sense. It's insulated from the world around it, and that includes the organism which carries it. Now, this really is quite close to some of the ideas that Richard Dawkins puts forward today. For Richard Dawkins, the gene, the selfish gene, is separate from the body, the processes in the body, so biochemical processes in the body, and it's separate from any environmental trigger. So nothing that happens to the organism, during its lifetime can be passed on to its offspring. So this is very different from the type of model of inheritance and variation that Darwin had, and different, very different from the ideas that Lamarck had. So Dawkins really sees himself as a bit of a champion of August Weismann's work. So he's a neo-Darwinian and a neo-Weismannist. Now, one of the important things here is that Richard Dawkins, unfortunately, isn't very good at history. Because one of the things that he has written out in some of his works in terms of the historical context of his ideas is that there has been a strong thread all the way through the 19th century, all the way through the 20th century, right up into the 21st century, of ideas that allow environmental triggers to impact on the gene line, the immortal gene line. So that environmental triggers, it has been theorized and suggested, and people have been experimenting to try and prove this for 150 years. There are people who have consistently been trying to show that this is not immortal. Even August Weismann himself came up with an idea called germinal selection later in his life, and he published germinal selection for the first time in 1894. He suggested here that environmental triggers could change the nature of what we would now think of as genes, so that biochemical processes in the environment of, say, a plant would change the reproductive cells, and that those changes in the characteristics of the plant would then be passed down generations. So even the person that Dawkins champions as being the top of the neo-Darwinian tree doesn't adhere to the ideas that Richard Dawkins does. And throughout the 20th century, there have been various people who've challenged this idea of an isolated, insulated germline. There's various people, some of the more famous people that you may have heard of is Barbara McClintock and her work on jumping genes. There's someone called Edward Steele, who's based in Australia, who published a book called Lamarck's Signature in 1998, which suggested that there was a feedback loop between the environment and the germline. And more recently, there's been lots of work in various areas, including EvoDevo and all the work that's coming out of epigenetics and epigenomics, which we'll discuss in a minute, which really, really is beginning to unpick this idea of an insulated germline. So one of my key points about Richard Dawkins is that he's not representing the historical context of his ideas, and he's not representing the current research either. Now, one of the other areas that Richard Dawkins is not very strong on, I'm afraid, is philosophy of science. And this is one of the areas that really links into something that I know people are probably quite interested to talk about, which is the science-religion debate. But it also links into ideas about how we communicate science. Dawkins is dogmatic. He suggests that there's one version of evolutionary biology, and he is, I guess, he's insulated from the rest of evolutionary biology. He doesn't take kindly to challenges. What he does, when there's new research, he expands his metaphors, selfish gene and extended phenotype, to encompass new research. Maybe here it's quite important to unpick the idea of metaphor in science. We tend to use metaphors as labels for describing a research area. They're not research drivers, they're just handy little catchphrases for describing what we see as research data. So I guess an example outside of biology would be describing atoms as being similar to the way the universe works, so the way that planetary bodies move. So it's a way of giving you a picture of how a very complex process works. It's really a handy label. So, and metaphors are quite often used in science, but they're not drivers for research programs. So Richard Dawkins is very good at communicating complex ideas, but he's not actually driving research, and he acknowledges this himself. And in fact, recently, a colleague related to me that he said to them that he is not even a scientist. So he doesn't see himself as a scientist anymore. So he's not working in the research area. He just has these labels. And these are the things that he promotes. The problem is that when there are challenges, he just tries to expand them and fit them in. Unfortunately, these labels aren't the best way of describing what's going on in evolutionary biology today. We need to think of some new labels, some new handy catchphrases to communicate these ideas, because it's getting a lot more complex. and the selfish gene metaphor doesn't really work anymore. And we might expand on this in a moment, but just to outline his other metaphor, which is that of the extended phenotype, I guess really here what he's suggesting is that the gene is separate from the organism, so separate from our bodies. We're just vehicles that carry our genes, and our genes through us can extend out and impact on the environment, but there is no backward flow. The environment can't impact on us. However, as we'll discuss now, that's up for a lot of debate.
It is really very refreshing to see someone young criticizing an old professor like Richard Dawkins. Very few people have dared to criticize his work, and with so many on so many different grounds, it's very nice. You refer to genes as human beings or being vehicles for the genes. How deterministic is Richard Dawkins, and how much do that infer in our society?
Okay. Is the mic on? Is it on? Ah, it's back on. You're correct there. Richard Dawkins is what we would call a genetic determinist. So this really ties into ideas about nature and nurture. For Richard Dawkins, really, in terms of evolution, everything is about our genes. And some people will take this a step further and suggest that all of our behaviour, everything that we do, is dominated by our genetic profile. Obviously, there are a lot of people that suggest that the environment in which you grow up in can have an impact on your behaviour as well. And Dawkins does have a very deterministic view of not only evolution, so it's quite constrained in the directions it can take, for example, which leaves us with some problems in terms of how species adapt quickly to environmental issues, so like a meteorite hitting the planet, for example. The approach that Dawkins has is quite gradual. So one of the areas that is problematic here in this kind of constrained version of genetics is that adaptation, quick succession of adaptation, is quite difficult to explain for Dawkins. The other thing is obviously with his genetic determined view, it's quite limiting in the way that we think about the potential for environmental factors to impact down the generations. And so he can't quite clearly explain some of the research data that's coming up today.
It's quite ironical. If human behavior is genetic, Dawkins' behavior is genetic, and therefore he is not free to express his thoughts.
I've often speculated on whether it's that Dawkins he's quite determined. I don't know whether that's...
We didn't have problems with evolution as explaining our biology, but once it comes to try to explain our behavior, that's another thing. It puts us in a very different ground, and it's not so easy to explain behavior. It's very easy to try to explain human beings as the result of genes. But once you know that genes are much more complex than they used to be, they used to be a single unit that produces a protein. And nowadays it's not so. A gene is a lot more than that. So it's very difficult to explain every single human characteristic as a reflection of something in the genome. It's a lot more complex than that. And besides that, genomes don't go around alone, on their own. They are an integral part of ourselves and of the environment. One can almost say, we were saying that yesterday, that the environment is so tight attached to the genome that is almost inside our genomes. So that makes it much more difficult to explain evolution but much more clear. It's not a genome evolving out there, but it's the tight union of genomes and environments, both evolving at the same time. So it's, that makes it very difficult to explain a single human characteristic as due to a single gene. We have only 25,000 genes and a lot more characteristics. Not every single one of them has a gene somewhere in our genome. So that makes it difficult for to understand Dawkins when one thinks of human beings as such a complex machine.
I think one of the areas that Richard Dawkins is quite keen on is evolutionary psychology, and that is very problematic in terms of explaining human behaviour through genetics, partly because it's quite speculative. I guess a good analogy would be if you have an archaeologist who is digging up remains on a site. Now, they will use scientific approaches to carbon date and to work out whether or not a skeletal remain is female, various things like that. But say the archaeologist finds a pot or a piece of jewellery. He can only speculate, I should say they can only speculate, on the use of the pot in terms of, well, obviously it's to contain something, but they can speculate that maybe it had some symbolic importance. And it's not a scientific speculation, it's more of a kind of historical reflection based on what we contemporarily may use these type of artifacts for today. And it's quite similar with evolutionary psychology. We can look at the kind of the genetic makeup of human beings today, but it's quite difficult for us to extrapolate backwards and think about why humans have adapted to certain things in the past. So there's, I mean, in Great Britain, there's been a lot of popular reports in the papers about, you know, how we should have a Stone Age diet and how we're adapted to eat a Stone Age diet and various other things. But this is actually speculation. It's not very scientific when you think about it because you're extrapolating backwards. So I think that's another difficult area for Dawkins is evolutionary psychology because he relies quite a lot on evolutionary psychology to talk about human behaviour. And again, it's another very speculative area.
Yeah, in another ironical fact is if you think behaviour is genetically determined, how on earth spend the whole life teaching at the university? There is no point in teaching if behavior is genetically determined. So one has to balance things in life and understand that genomes and environment work together to produce a human being like any one of us.
It's quite a depressing view of human society if you think that you can't change human society through education. So, yes, I think that's one area where Dawkins slightly flounders. And obviously he's got other ideas about cultural evolution, so his ideas about memes, so ideas spread in a way similar to genes, which again doesn't allow for the possibility of interchange of ideas between cultures or cultural development. So it's quite problematic.
We talk about cultural evolution and we can follow it from Lucy, the first skeleton in Addis Abeba, to ourselves, to find out that the evolution of culture has been a lot faster than our biological evolution. And for the first time in the 20th century, our biological evolution can be interfered by our cultural evolution. We can now handle our genes. Something we learned to do, that's part of our cultural evolution, can now go into our biological evolution. For the first time in history, the beings evolving, the evolution of human beings is in the hands of the man evolving, of the human being evolving, which, of course, sets up a lot of bioethical questions and all sorts of problems to our society that we have to face in the future, and we are facing nowadays anyway. So we have to think of both sides, the culture and the genome, and both are capable of producing our societies, human bodies, and so on and so on.
I think one of the examples in terms of epigenetics. So, I mean, epigenetics is basically, and I have to say here that epigenetics as a term is quite contested. So it has different meanings depending on your disciplinary background. But very simply, it's processes of inheritance that occur outside the kind of insulated gene line. In some disciplines, it's seen as the process of triggers, environmental triggers affecting gene expression, and others argue that these environmental triggers not only affect gene expression during the lifetime of the organism, but that they can also be inherited. So the changes caused by the environmental triggers can be inherited. One piece of research in humans that's suggested that nutrition can have a long-term impact on health down generations. So I'm thinking of the work of Marcus Pembrey on the starvation studies, the Dutch starvation studies, whereby a grandparent's generation was subject to famine. And the impact of this famine has been epigenetically passed down the generations. So it doesn't just impact on the children, it impacts on the great-grandchildren, and there's a higher expression of it at heart disease and diabetes, if my memory serves me correctly. So there's a lot of very interesting and quite, as you pointed out, controversial and issues that will leave us with quite a few big ethical debates that are on the horizon at the moment. The more research that's done into these processes of inheritance that occur due to environmental triggers, there's some going to leave us with some fairly big questions as humanity. And also in terms of thinking about the way that we interact with the environment, so environmental change in terms of climate change could have an extra layer of a dimension of concern for us, I think, if we're thinking about the impact of biochemical influences on human development. I think one of the areas that we've kind of touched on, which I know you wanted to talk about, was lateral gene transfer. I think this kind of links in a way to what we're talking about, crossing cultures.
Nowadays we have quite a lot more modes of inherit things from our parents. There used to be only the Mendelian ways. But now we know that the genome is like a musical partiture. And every single violinist plays the partiture in a different way. And the virtuoso plays it in the superb way. So it's not enough to have a partiture to have good music. That the way the partitura is played is what we call nowadays epigenetics. Mechanisms that play the DNA partitura and play it in different ways. We have an epigenetic map of the pancreas, which is which genes are played and when are played, and which ones are switched off. That's the partitura of the pancreas, and another one for the liver, and so on. All the musicians in the orchestra have the same partitura, but the oboe will never play the part of the violin. But they all pass the page at the same time. Have you seen that? In spite of the fact that they may not be playing that part of the partitura. And the same happens in the organism. Only to have a partitura, you can't hear Mozart there, unless you get someone to play it for you. And that playing it for you are all the mechanisms that allow the expression of the genes. Some genes will be switched off, some others will be switched on, and so on. So that adds complexity to our understanding of human beings. It's not only a sequence of letters down there in the genome, but the way in which those letters are executed. And that is one of the most interesting areas of research nowadays. How on earth are these genes played? Why these are switched on? Why these are switched off?
why some genes may be read by the fetus, for instance, and say, this gene comes from my father, so I'll switch it off. And this one comes from my mother, and I'll switch it off, and so on. And that gives us new ideas about the mechanism of inheritance of a new sort of genetic diseases that we are identifying nowadays. So look at the complexity of this. How on earth can be our conduct or alcoholism, whatever you name it, be genetic?
One of the other areas is the idea that genes can be transferred between different organisms. So just to explain, lateral gene transfer, or what sometimes called horizontal gene transfer. Probably the example you will be most aware of is the transfer of antibiotic resistance in bacteria. Basically, antibiotic resistance in bacteria is where is transferred between bacterial communities. So it doesn't even have to be the same species or strain of bacteria. Say I'm one bacteria and Jamie's another bacteria. Sorry, I don't mean to insult you, but actually unicellular organisms are quite interesting. say I develop resistance to antibiotics. I can take the genetic information, for want of a better term, that codes for that resistance, and I can give it to Jamie, and he can put it into his genome, and then it's inherited by all of your offspring, so to speak.
And it seems that it's possible to find also horizontal gene transfer in higher organisms, not only in bacteria. So I even remember someone identifying some snake genes in a cow.
Yes.
So maybe genes floating around and looking where to stick to someone. So a lot still to learn to be deterministic.
It really breaks down the idea of the tree of life as well, which is something that, for those of you that know about Darwin, he draws the tree of life in Origin of Species, and this tends to be the way that we think of evolution. So you have the, for want of a better term, and I use Darwin's words here, lower life forms at the bottom of the trunk, and then you diversify. And obviously we're up here, and we've got branches where we've got a common ancestor. But normally, when you think of the tree of life, or historically, all of these lines have been separate. There's no exchange of genetic information between one branch over here and another branch over here. However, if you think about horizontal gene transfer, there can be. As James pointed out, you find snake genes in cows. And that means that there's been transfer of information between this branch here and this branch here, and they're normally seen as quite separate. So one of the things that's really, really interesting at the moment is that we're finding more and more of this evidence for lateral gene transfer in all sorts of species, and it's even been suggested that a lot of what we see as the human genome has come from other species at various points. So this is a probably more speculative area at the moment. I think one of the things it certainly shows is because we know that it happens a lot within bacterial communities and within the kind of unicellular organisms, we certainly know that the tree of life may be quite a useful metaphor still for the higher organisms, but the roots are all intermeshed. There's a lot of exchange of information between species. And Barbara McIntock, actually, she did some of the groundbreaking research in this area, showing that you can transfer genes from one maize plant to another maize plant through the bacterial communities in the soil. So the bacteria that live on the roots would pass genetic information between two separate maize plants, which is then inherited by each maize plant. So the whole concept of inheritance that we tend to have, and the one that Richard Dawkins certainly puts across, is much more simple than actually what we're finding. It's much more complex. And this is one of the things, as someone who's quite passionate about the sciences, I find worrying that the loudest voice in communicating evolutionary biology doesn't reflect all of this stuff that's going on, which is really exciting. And it worries me in terms of bringing younger generations into the biological sciences, because when someone's really dogmatic about the sciences, it doesn't make it like a very interesting area to go into. When I talk to scientific colleagues of mine about why they are scientists, it's because they want to make new discoveries. They want to have what is sometimes referred to as the feeling of standing on the edge of the universe, looking out. The idea that you're discovering something that no one else knows, and for a moment you're the only person who knows this. It is really exciting. I mean, I've had it by association when people send me research papers and it's something really new and it hasn't been published, and it is a really exciting feeling. For someone like Dawkins to present science in a way that's dogmatic and closed down and there's no creative process there, I think it discourages people from coming into the discipline, which is a shame because there's so much going on.
Well, we have only 15 minutes left, so we have to perhaps come to the end with this question. Mm. If Darwin were alive today or were able to come back, what parts of science do you think he would be really surprised with?
I think he'd be very excited by the things that we've been talking about today, because they really, actually, they're closer to his thinking. That what's going on in the past 5-10 years in terms of epigenetics is a lot closer to Darwin's thinking in terms of inheritance than perhaps the classical model of genetics was. So I think he'd be very interested in that. I think it would be interesting to pick his brains about what he thinks about the loss of biodiversity, because we were discussing this yesterday.
Yeah.
Because obviously extinction is really quite an important aspect in Darwin's work. So is extinction a problem, or is it a natural process within evolution?
I think it would be very interested in knowing that we can do studies in archaic DNA.
Oh, yes.
And go back to his old fossils and analyze them nowadays. I think he will be quite exultant about that.
I agree.
Perhaps forensic DNA, the evidence of unicity within diversity, that you can identify a single individual in spite of the fact that we are so diverse. I think there will be quite a lot of interesting aspects in which Darwin will be really surprised.
No, I agree. I think he would. I mean, the thing about Darwin, the reason that I love Darwin as an academic, is because he's just so interested and excited by so many different ideas, and he's so creative in the way that he approaches them. He never loses that boyhood fascination with wanting to know about different things. He spends his entire life, I'm talking about as though he's still alive, he spent his entire life in his garden experimenting with things, so he was obsessed by like earthworms and climbing plants, and I think that he would have that ongoing fascination today. What would be interesting would be to see what he thought of the celebrations we've just had. I think he was quite a shy and retiring man. He probably would have been a bit overwhelmed by the international celebrations.
Well, thank you, Ferran.
Thank you, Jim.
It was very nice to talk to you today. And we open space for questions to the audience, please.
I wanted to ask, what controls what genes are expressed?
How do organisms choose which genes are expressed?
Yeah.
Do you want to?
Sure.
How do organisms choose which genes are expressed? What processes? That's a difficult one.
I wish we knew that. We don't even know how single organs select the genes they have to play and which they don't. That's part of a very interesting process in biology called differentiation, which means that the cells are underdifferentiated before, and then they become committed to certain type of work. And in that process, they select the genes they will play. And they will play them forever, unless you get a cancer, in which case the cells de-differentiate, go back, and express genes that were not allowed to express as an organ. But we know nothing about that.
Hello, I have a question which is probably a little bit outside of the subject you're dealing with, and it's creationism. My question is, what is there that causes this very strong wave, particularly North America, against the fact of evolution and against the mechanics of evolution? Let us say it. Creativists are against both things. Is there some fundamental reason for this opposition? And what would be the solution to enlighten these unenlightened people?
Okay.
I forgot to talk about that.
Yes, we unfortunately forgot about science and religion. Okay, I think U.S. creationism is much more political than perhaps people realize. In the U.S., there isn't religious teaching on school curriculum, so part of the drive of creationist and intelligent design proponents is to get a religious perspective on the school curriculum. I'd say one of the things that you have to remember, though, is that creationism is actually only a minority view, really, within the kind of broader context. As part of the British Council project Darwin Now, we undertook some research in 10 countries, including the US, last year, looking at attitudes towards evolution and ideas about creationism and deistic, theistic evolution, because there are a large number of scientists who are religious, evolutionary biologists who are religious. It's perfectly possible and plausible to be both of faith and an evolutionary biologist. In fact, were you saying earlier, Jamie, that there was a poll that showed that 40% of scientists are in some way religious?
It's mentioned by Francis Collins, which is the director of the Human Genome Program, and he mentions there that 40% of the scientists in the world are believers in God. So it's very interesting. It's one in two.
I think internationally, if you look beyond the US, the issue to do with creationism is more to do with access to education, and also because there are a couple of unfortunate myths about Darwinism, and one which can be quite problematic is the idea that Darwinism in some countries is seen as solely as the idea that Darwin said we descended directly from chimpanzees. Obviously, he didn't say that. He said that we evolved from a common ancestor. I think that there's a lot of confusion about what Darwinism and evolution represent, and unfortunately, globally, it's not necessarily reflected within the school curriculum in a way that it should be. I think that's possibly one of the ways that we would perhaps increase understanding of evolutionary science. I think we need to be careful, though, because evolution isn't a conversion experience, it's a scientific idea. So really, I think one of the most important things is to communicate how science works. I think communicating the nature of science, so scientific methodology, science within its context, social context, is really quite important. And I think this isn't just important for evolutionary science, it's really important for public understanding of medicine, for example. So in Great Britain, we've had a huge scandal over the past 10 years or so about the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. There was an erroneous scientific paper that was put out that suggested there was a link between this combined vaccine and the onset of autism in children. And so many people were worried by this, even though it was later shown to be rather, for want of a better word, dodgy science. Loads of people stopped vaccinating their children. So in the UK, we don't have herd immunity for mumps anymore, and there have been mumps outbreaks in the UK. Which obviously mumps is a very serious disease, and it's very upsetting that because there has been a lack of sensible communication about how science works, people don't engage with the implications of the speculation that there's a link between a vaccination in autism when actually there's no scientific evidence to support that claim. And it's been shown repeatedly that there is no scientific evidence to support that claim. So I think what we really need to do in terms of teaching science and communicating science is really look at the historical, the philosophical, and the sociological context of science, as well as communicating the actual ideas and the evidence for the theories that we want to communicate.
Just anecdotal, but at the end of the year, we held a meeting organized by the British Council in Bibliotheca Alexandria, the heart of the Islamic world in Egypt. If you go to the blog of that meeting, you will find a lot of comments from Islamics against evolution and in favor of creationism.
I know the person you're talking about when you said there's one person who's been quite vocal on that. One of the things that's quite important with the Bibliotheca Alexandrina conference is that we actually had a very large number of articles published about the conference in Arabic, with an audience reach of 298 million over all of the Arabic countries that we were working in, and every single one was positive and pro-evolution, which I think was quite encouraging. So it was a very interesting event. Sorry, but we should be allowing you to ask questions rather than talking amongst ourselves.
There's a question there.
Buenos días. Buenos días. I'm going to speak in Spanish, if you let me.
Of course.
Hace menos de un año estuve comentando recientemente que de unos estudios genéticos en los cuales se hacía la hipótesis de que la información de que lo, a través de los genes se podía transmitir un conocimiento cultural de generación en generación. La conferencista comentaba sobre la genética cultural y me llama mucho la atención por esta sencilla razón, porque tradicionalmente se deslinda los estudios científicos de los estudios culturales, y a partir de estos estudios y lo que usted comentaba se ve como una relación entre la genética y cómo la genética podría contener información que se transmite culturalmente. Personalmente me gustaría, no que usted profundizará mucho por cuestiones de tiempo, pero sí que hablar un poco al respecto, porque es muy interesante ver esta relación entre las ciencias y la cultura. Muchas gracias.
¿Quién era la conferencista primero para poderme orientar un poco? Porque hablamos más bien en forma metafórica de la herencia cultural, ¿no? Pero que ya tratemos de meter la cultura entre los genes es tan fuera de lugar como meter los genes entre la cultura. De modo que, a pesar de que entendemos que hay una, que están pegados el genoma con el ambiente, y pues meter en los genes lo que tenemos que hacer los papás con los hijos no tiene mucho sentido. Tenemos que enseñarles y criarlos, y todo eso no está metido en los genes. Obviamente tiene que estar metido en los genes. Para poder amamantar un hijo hay que tener una serie de genes que hagan que el embrión se desarrolle de sexo femenino, y después que tenga la menarquia y senos y eso para poderlo amamantar. O sea que no se puede sacar lo uno de lo otro ni meter entre los genes todo lo que queramos. No tenemos sino 25.000 genes, ¿dónde nos caben la lectura del Quijote y todo eso? Es muy difícil, muy, muy difícil meter todo eso allí.
Can I just add to that as well? We were just speaking metaphorically about cultural evolution. I think there's a very big difference between some behavioural triggers in early life, certainly within mammals there are some examples, and cultural inheritance. I think we need to be very careful to make that distinction between the idea that our behaviour can impact that heavily upon the expression of our phenotypes down the years, that will down the generations. So I think there are two extremes within evolutionary biology. One is genetic determinism, and one is environmental determinism, which is the idea that obviously everything can feed into the units that are inherited. And we're somewhere in the middle, I would say.
Yeah. In a way, culture is one of the epigenetic events of the human genome. It may, in some ways, modify our genome, the expression of some of our genes, because of the food, environmental toxics, and so on. So it can do it. But it's not inside our genes. Mm. It's outside their culture.
Buenos días. Bueno, esta es la siguiente. Usted hablaba de que cada vez pues hay más avances en cuanto a la ciencia para dar respuesta a las preguntas que tenía Darwin y para poder profundizar en el mecanismo fino del cómo de el modelo que él propuso de evolución de las especies. Sin embargo, cuando vemos todo el proceso de todos los avances que hay en términos moleculares, por ejemplo, se ve que cada vez hay muchos más detalles que no se conocen y que cada vez es más difícil mostrar un modelo comunicable que permita mostrar la complejidad de lo que es el mecanismo fino de ese proceso. Entonces mi pregunta es, ¿usted cree que alguna vez el ser humano llegará a ser capaz de explicar el mecanismo fino del origen y evolución de las especies, del cómo de lo que Darwin nos puso en la mente hace 150 años? Gracias.
I think that there will be a point in which we can answer some of the questions that we're beginning to research today, but I think one of the beauties of science is it's dynamic and it's reflexive and it's creative, and we will answer questions, but this will throw up new questions, and that I think is one of the most beautiful things about science, is it's not about dogma, it's not about setting up ideas as permanent structures. They're not monolithic. When we talk about scientific fact, we're talking about something that could, in the future, be disproved. And I think that's one of the things that's most interesting. And I think, in answer to the first part of your question about communicating the complexity, I think, again, if we think about communicating science as a whole, as a process, I think that will help people understand how the complexity is reflected in the current research. One of the comments I've had about writing my book is that, well, you know, Richard Dawkins does a good job because he makes it very simple. And, you know, the public, they can't understand the complexity of science. Well, I think that's wrong. I think the public are perfectly capable of understanding the complexity of science. And I think that it's very bad science communication to assume that your audience can't understand that part of it. And also, I think it makes it more boring. It's not as exciting. You don't get the kind of standing on the edge of the universe feel. So, yes, we will answer these questions, but hopefully, and definitely I would say, we will have even more questions.
You talked about maize and bacterial communities. How can genes transfer horizontally?
Horizontal transfer?
Yeah. So how can genes transfer between organisms? They use transposons and plasmids.
Once we found viruses and retroviruses, we found that the central dogma of molecular biology, which is DNA copies in RNA and RNA in a protein, we found that, and we thought that it could only go that way, from DNA to protein and not from protein to DNA. But we found out those viruses and found that they have an enzyme called reverse transcriptase, which allows to go back from RNA to DNA. So the central dogma came down, and we had to accept that there are some other ways of going from DNA to RNA to protein. We still can't go to, from protein to RNA, but we can go from RNA to DNA. So viruses may be a good vector for that horizontal gene transfer, because they can take DNA from our cells and inscribe it in another host by means of the reverse transcriptase and insert that in there. And that's how one expects that a snake's DNA may be in a cow, because someone took it from there and put it there. And the only possible candidate nowadays is a retrovirus.
Mm. Yeah. You explained it better than I did. Mm? I think that we're probably coming to an end now.
Yeah. So, another question, perhaps the last?
Yeah.
Si partimos, la pregunta tiene que ver con el tiempo real.
Okay.
Si partimos del concepto que la ciencia y la investigación científica es una construcción social que parte de la sociedad que la genera, ¿cómo podríamos comprender que una intelectual y una científica muy joven proponga una, como rescatar el determinismo social de hace 200 años en una propuesta como más dialéctica de la evolución? O sea, ¿qué está pasando en la sociedad inglesa que nos permite esta nueva corriente de pensamiento?
Are you suggesting that I'm saying that science is all socially contingent? Okay, I'll answer the question I think you're saying. I'm not implying that all of science is a social construct. Clearly, obviously, there is the natural world that we're observing is a uniformity across social and cultural contexts. The point is, we cannot. I mean, I think whilst rejecting cultural relativism in science, we cannot ignore the fact that science is part of a process. That there is obviously a context to the individual scientist. That doesn't mean that what they're observing isn't objective. It just means that we have to understand that there is a methodological construct for the way they are using empiricism. I'm certainly not saying that science is culturally relativistic. I think that is a fallacy. But to go down the other end, where you say that science is separate from society and culture, again, is a fallacy. It's not really, cultural relativism is not really on the rise in the UK. Don't worry about that.
Bueno, muchas gracias. Yo le agradezco nuevamente a Fern.